Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new edition of the OPC Foundation podcast, the home of industrial interoperability. My name is Peter Seeberg, and I'm your host. Today, I have two guests, Enrico Novak and Andreas Schütte. They are both from Airbus Defense and Space. And we're going to be talking about the use of OPC-UA in rockets, specifically in the Texas Research Rocket. Hello, Enrico. How are you?
I'm fine.
Hello, Andreas. How are you?
I'm fine as well, Peter.
So, Enrico, let's start with you. Please introduce yourself to our listeners.
I am Enrico, and I'm working in the Texas program since several years here, and I'm responsible for the avionics system.
Andreas, same thing for you. Who are you? What do you do?
Yeah, my name is Andreas Schütte. I'm the program manager for the Sonic Rocket program at Airbus, located in Bremen, Germany.
Okay, let's talk rocket science. I don't do that every day. I guess most of you listeners don't do so either. So to start with, what is the Texas Research Rocket and why is it significant?
Well, the Texas rocket is a research rocket which is flying without humans inside. It is roughly 30 meters long, has a mass of 2,700 kilograms, out of which roughly one-tenth, 280 kilograms, are reserved for scientific and technological experiments. It was initiated almost 50 years ago in 1976 as a German program to conduct experiments under microgravity conditions. From the beginning, there were European researchers involved as well, besides the German ones. And in the beginning, it was the German Space Agency who was our customer and contracting us. And later in 1982, beginning with Texas 6, the European Space Agency was conducting experiments as well. So we had two different customers, which is still the case today. With Texas, we offer unique opportunities for all kinds of different scientific disciplines, biological, material science experiments, physical experiments, you name it. And we provide an environment of up to 6 minutes of microgravity time. We perform the launches of those Texas rockets from S-Range Space Center, which is located in the north of Sweden near the city of Kiruna. We reach an apogee, that is the maximum height during the flight of the rocket, of roughly 250 kilometers. And the rocket parts, the rocket motors, as well as the payload, all land inhabited landing zone of S-Range. And that is exactly the reason why we perform these rocket launches from there, because this is an uninhabited area where there is no danger to people if we launch rockets.
Sounds very interesting. Now, I happen to live not too far away from the Airbus site, south of Munich. Not sure that you guys go there because you're based on a different site, but driving, walking past that site, there is this rocket. I always thought it was a model. It's kind of in the driveway entrance. So not sure you know that one, but would that be the kind and type of rocket I should be thinking about when we talk Texas?
I'm not sure I have seen this rocket, so I can't really tell. But there is a Maxus rocket, a model, in the city of Kiruna. So if you happen to be in the north of Sweden, in the city of Kiruna, you will see a Maxus rocket, which is, I call it, the bigger sister of the Texas rocket, which is a little bit more powerful and provides more space for experiments and a longer microgravity time. Unfortunately, this Maxus rocket is currently not active, but it's still available. And if there is a customer, I would be very happy to fly it.
Very good. I've been wanting to go visit my good friend in Sweden for almost 20 years. if I'm ever going to make it, I'm going to make sure to pass by the Maxis rocket. Now, most of you listeners will have heard about Airbus. For me specifically, as I just said, also when flying, returning home from abroad, it's like, you know, when flying an Airbus plane, you know, it's like home for me starts kind of in the foreign country, you know, seeing the plane. But today we're not talking airplanes, we're talking rockets. So maybe you can tell us more about the Airbus defense space in the context of the bigger organization, Airbus, in relation to the Texas rocket.
Yeah, in Bremen, we've had the beginning of the Texas program. And at that time, we were still a different company called Ernu Raumfahrttechnik. And this was a small company founded in the early 60s. And in this context, we developed a lot of space-related facilities. One of the most prominent examples is, from the beginning, the so-called Space Lab. That was a laboratory which flew on board the shuttle several times, many times. We actually built two of those models, and one of them is located in the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, and the other model is located in Bremen. And in this context, to prepare the experiments on the space lab, experiment facility, experiment laboratory, the Texas program was founded. And the purpose was to determine parameters of experiments and demonstrate capabilities of experiment facilities to prepare them for the longer research times that are or would be available in the space lab. And that is why this was located then in Bremen. And we still are doing this as our main work, besides the organization of the rocket launches, the launch campaigns, procuring the rocket motors from our subcontractor. We also procure the service system, which makes sure that the communication between the experiments and the ground stations, where we as the engineers are supporting the scientists in real time during the flight. And yeah, the major part of our work is the development of the experiment facilities. And this is done in very, very close coordination and collaboration with the science teams. We ask them how they do it in the lab, want to understand what they need to get in terms of results. And that's our starting point for the development of such a facility. And during this whole process, we are in close coordination with them and our customers to make sure that the experiments do exactly what they shall do.
Sounds good. Then let's get into the experiments. What type of experiments are typically conducted aboard the Texas rockets?
The majority of the experiments is indeed covering fundamental research questions. But there's also dedicated and specific applications that are investigated, as well as testing, demonstrating of technologies. The disciplines are multiple. I mean, we have flown living cells for biology experiments. We have flown little fish. We have flown cells and analyzed them with a specific dedicated 3D laser scanning microscope for cancer research and gene analysis, material physics like melting alloys, titanium, aluminum alloys, which are interesting for many applications, and solidifying them. Combustion experiments where we burn iron powder, for example. Fluid physics, where we determine how liquid is flowing through capillary veins to support the simulations for satellite tank fueling and so many other things. It's a whole variety of experiments. And one thing which is always interesting to start with a new experiment, we learn something new every time we have a new payload.
Do you want to share maybe one of those examples in a little bit more of detail?
Yeah, I just mentioned the fish experiment. The reason why we flew little fish, we had 72 of them on board, was to determine theory or to substantiate a theory which the scientist had, that the little fish have also a tendency with a certain statistical probability to get seasick or motion sick, let's put it that way. You probably have heard of travel sickness. When you're traveling in a car and reading a book, not looking out the window, you start feeling dizzy. It happens to some of us. Astronauts, for example, get also space sick. And the same thing was assumed to be the case with little fish. The question behind it was, what is causing this? The assumption is that the senses in little fish are the same as in humans. We have little stones in our inner ear, the so-called otoliths, with which we are able to determine where is up and where is down. The little fish have one of the otoliths on the left and one on the right-hand side in their ears, and therefore it is pretty easy to determine the size of these otoliths. The assumption was, and it was confirmed after the flight, that if the otoliths are different in size, the fish have a strong tendency to get motion sick. We observed these 72 little fishes individually and held them in individual small containers, which we could see with camera. And indeed, there was a certain percentage of them who showed a strange swimming behavior. And the analysis later showed that these little fish had indeed different sizes of these otoliths. And therefore, this theory of the scientist was confirmed. And the next step would then be to determine the reason why these otoliths are different in size. And this is something which would then or could then help determine a cure for people who tend to get motion sick.
Why would that be in space rather than down on Earth?
Yeah, the reason is that this strange swimming behavior can only be observed in space, because this is the reduction of a sense which induces this behavior. And this cannot be observed on the ground. You cannot bring a fish to read a newspaper while they're swimming.
Maybe that's a general reason for doing certain experiments in space, is the reduction of complexity, which we have on Earth. Or I'm going to go too far into the experiments, but just in case.
Yeah, actually, if you imagine you're looking through a milky glass, you see there is a person behind it, but you cannot really tell who it is. If you remove this milky glass, you suddenly see features like fingers, a face, a nose, an eye, ears. You see who that is. And it's similar to space. Gravity is something which we experience every day. We cannot really imagine how it would be without gravity, unless you've experienced it yourself in a parabolic flight, for example, or if you've been in space. But there are too few people to really experience that. But anyway, the gravity is a driver for many physical phenomena which we observe here on the ground and which are normal for us. For example, if you mix water and oil, you get an emulsion. You get little oil bubbles in the water. If you leave the bottle with this mixture standing, water and oil separate again rather quickly, because there are density differences and the lighter oil tends to float on top of the water with the higher density.
Very good. Interesting.
This segregation happens due to gravity, and this does not happen under space conditions.
Okay, so gravity as the Milky Glass. Is that one that you want to go into a little bit further as well?
Yes, that is a second very good example, and that is related to several experiments we performed already, one with the bigger Maxis rocket I mentioned in the beginning, and twice on the Texas rocket. We are burning iron powder. The purpose behind it is if we burn this iron powder, it is not like a burning gas. There is a different physical phenomenon behind it. One iron particle is ignited and it generates heat when it oxidizes, and such ignites then the next iron particle or the closest iron particle, which then burns and ignites the next. So it's propagating, it's jumping from particle to particle, this flame. This is a phenomenon which is observable here on the ground as well, but the equations are dominated again by gravity because the particles are heavy and fall very quickly. So we do this in space to observe how these particles really burn. And from that, we can optimize the models and find out if there are different materials and different oxygen gas compositions, which would lead to better results in terms of heating capacity that can be the result of this burning process. Actually, there is a brewery in the Netherlands which uses this iron powder burning as heat generation for their brewing processes. The advantage is that these iron powder particles, they oxidize, creating basically rust, something like rust, which can be collected. And if you use hydrogen to reduce the iron oxide back to iron, then you have a closed loop, which is CO2-free, provided that the hydrogen is produced CO2-free. And the interesting aspect is that the energy density or capacity of the iron powder is comparable to our normal gas we use in cars. So from the mass to energy ratio, it is comparable. And this could be an interesting alternative in the future. And that's why the scientists are investigating this topic.
Wow, impressive, amazing. What can be done? For what reason scientists do these experiments in space? Now, let's move towards the use of OPC-UA in space, starting with what is the role that data transmission plays in conducting these experiments in space?
Yeah, data transmission plays a major role in every phase of the experiment. It starts even before the rocket launch. Just before liftoff, we check that all experiments are operating normally. And at this point in time, we need to be certain that all systems are functioning as expected. During the flight itself, then the scientists can monitor the progress of the experiments in real time, and they have video available as well as data, and that allows them to exactly observe what is happening on board. Since these experiments often explore the unknown, one can predict how they really will evolve, and therefore we have the capability to send commands to the experiment modules. So if something unexpected is happening, or if the scientists see something particularly interesting, then they can adjust parameters, they can control the timing of certain actions, or they can even focus more closely on a specific part of the experiment. I think this flexibility is essential for making most of out of the time, of the limited time.
Okay, so transmission is important. Now, moving towards OPC UA, which we all know as a communication architecture, including and built on top of a modeling language, very important, but including transport, as we just talked about, mechanisms, security as well. Why is it that you selected to start with OPC UA into the Texas Rocket?
So there were two key reasons why we have decided for OPC UA. One key reason was that we wanted to use a commercial product. So we wanted to save the time in developing a custom application. So we wanted to save time just by using a commercial product for the development and also for the maintenance. But that is not the only reason. The other thing is that with using an open standard, we also can invite a larger group of developers to take part in our developments. What was also vital for us was that we wanted to have a mature system and a product which also has proven its reliability in industrial applications. Reliability plays a major role in our space applications. The second reason why we have chosen OPC UA was because we wanted to enable our developers. We wanted to give them the flexibility to design the experiment modules around the need of the scientists. And OPC UA offers a unique approach of data definition that exactly enables that. Once the developers have defined the data structure, it can then be used by all applications in our systems. By this, we avoid errors and data misinterpretation. So we can have two things at the same time. We can have flexibility for the developers, and we also can have data consistency in the system. I think that's really great.
How was then OPC UA integrated into the Texas program? I mean, did you do it all by yourself? Did you get any help from a startup, from any OPC UA software company? I was part of one of them myself. Any education of OPC UA?
So we started our journey in 2016. And right from the beginning, we received support from Unified Automation, namely by Mr. Matthias Damm. One has to know that OPC UA is much more than just a communication standard. It also covers the aspect of data management. So there are a lot of functions and there are a lot of opportunities. And Mr. Damm helped us to define the best concept for our project. This concept was then formalized in a so-called OPC UA support specification. After the definition of our concept, we then started to step-by-step bringing in individual components in our system. We still maintained our old communication architecture, because this is a continuous program and we didn't want to interrupt the ongoing missions and the ongoing experiments. So we maintained both systems in parallel. By 2025, we then aimed to complete the transition. And from this time, we then want to entirely rely on OPC UA for data communication and data management.
Okay, so how exactly does the communication between the Texas rocket and the ground station work? Did you run into specific challenges there?
Yeah, many space missions suffer high latencies, which are caused by the huge distances in space. This is different for Texas because the rocket flies in a height of only 260 kilometers. That means that we can send and receive data almost in real time, and this allows us to use OPC UA in a bidirectional communication. However, many tools from our colleagues of Airbus are based on the unidirectional communication. So we can't use these tools directly to overcome this situation. We need to support both unidirectional as well as bidirectional communication. And this is then where the PubSub feature of OPC UA came into the game, because PubSub is unidirectional, and with the implementation of PubSub, we can now support both communication methods. And in autumn this year, 2024, there will be the first experiment which will send down its telemetry data using the PubSub feature of OPC UA.
Okay, so how is the real-time data transmission used in the program, and what was unique about the recent applications?
Okay, real-time data transmission is used ever since the first launch of Texos, because it allowed the scientists to monitor the experiment and it allowed them to quickly respond if needed. What made the recent application unique was the development or the deployment of the cloud technology. And that made the data available in real time also to those who weren't physically present at the launch site in Kiruna. So, for example, we had one scientist which was traveling in a public transport, and with his mobile device, he was able to watch his experiment flying in space. And another notable case was the Phoenix 2 experiment. That experiment was provided by Japan. And here there were around 50 scientists and students watching the flight, the Texas flight from Tokyo. So the ability to share live data globally has made for us the collaboration much easier and more efficient.
Sounds exciting, yeah. So how has the introduction of real-time data transmission via the cloud, as you just explained, how has it impacted, you would say, the scientific collaboration we just heard? Japan, for example, also the execution of the experiments.
Yeah, Enrico just explained it with these two good examples. It enables international teams to collaborate in real time during the flight, regardless of where they are on the planet. And a second advantage is that during the preparation time of the experiments, when we test and show data and operation of their experiments to the science teams, there is not necessarily the need for them to travel to here, so they don't have to be physically present. And this saves travel costs and travel time. And this closer cooperation and collaboration increases the international scientific networks. It improves them and strengthens them. And this is something which is very beneficial for the exchange of data and scientific results. And in the end, we expect that we will have new partnerships with different science teams from all over the world, as the barriers are lowered to participate in sounding rocket experiments.
So reducing the need for physical presence is one of the additional capabilities, very similar to us recording this podcast from different sites on Earth, still on Earth, maybe in space sometime, who knows. So you already mentioned why you have chosen the OPC UA communication architecture. What would you consider advantages on one hand and maybe challenges on the other hand of using OPC UA?
So one has to keep in mind that we have one system which is flying in space. That is, let's say, a small part of the rocket. And we have also a large infrastructure here on ground. So with the standardization, we really can implement a proven communication which is used across the different system and which is used across the different platforms. It simplifies how we can manage and how we can process the data. And it really allows us to handle large volumes of data. And this is true for the mission as well as after the mission. The challenge we had is that OPC UA requires an Ethernet connection to operate on. So we had to renew our communication system so that it is capable then also to provide Ethernet to space.
Which is what you had not had beforehand?
Yes, that's true.
But that was solvable, I understand.
Yes, so it took, required some significant adjustment and coordination in the ground and in the flight system, but it was manageable.
So Dan, what future developments have you planned and are in planning with OPC UA?
So our focus remains also in the future on data security. Base missions are getting more and more complex, and keeping data safe is even more important than ever. OPC UA already has a strong built-in capabilities, but we are looking together with them constantly to improve even that. And that will help us to ensure that data which is collected during the mission is protected from the start to the finish. On top of that, we want to give the scientists the same level of independence that our development engineers already enjoy. We want to enable them to manage their experiments autonomously without needing constant technical support. And we are working on creating a complete new user experience powered by artificial intelligence.
That sounds definitely interesting to me, because there is this other industrial AI podcast. We do move backwards, forwards. Industrial AI talk about the use of, well, you know, let me just share one piece, because I've always said OPC UA makes AI fly in general because of the information modeling capability. But not sure what you're thinking of that. But, you know, great to hear that you're thinking further with regards to artificial intelligence. So is there maybe then a follow-up question in relationship to what I just said, you know, related to OPC UA providing the information modeling capability, putting some kind of whatever you're thinking of, I don't know, machine learning, Gen AI, other kind of artificial intelligence capabilities on top of it?
I think AI, that is really a broad field of technologies and application. And you are certainly right that there will be also a link to what you have been talking about. We already at a certain extent provide some measures or some technologies that support this implementation of AI, and definitely a door opener here is that we use OPC UA as a communication standard, so it's easy to connect and to link future tools to that.
Yes, definitely strong agreement from my side. So would you consider the integration of OPC UA into Texas as a significant advancement for research?
A clear yes. OPC UA offers really an improved quality of the data by avoiding errors during the transfer of one data set from one computer to the next, because it's seamlessly integrated. And we can also handle a lot more data than in the past. This increases our flexibility when we develop our experiment modules, and it also provides a modularity, which makes it a lot easier for us to just take building blocks as we need them and integrate them. I also talked about the strengthening of the scientific research community and working across borders and from wherever we are on the planet. And this will definitely lead to a much better exchange of data and much easier exchange of data. And from the perspective point of view, we see that experiments produce more and more data. And this is exactly what we can support with the OPC UA standard. And in the end, we see that OPC UA is developing to a huge ecosystem all over the world in various industries. And we're sure that there's going to be further developments and an evolution with future cases we cannot imagine today, but which could potentially be useful for us in the Texas program and for Airbus as company. And that's why we strongly support this on our end.
Sounds great. I'm happy that you're happy with having chosen OPC UA. Enrico, Andreas, thank you very much. I already just mentioned, some listeners may have heard me say before, OPC UA makes AI fly. But I guess I have to update the quote to include rockets as well. Pun intended. So, if you want to learn more about OPC UA technology, about the OPC Foundation, you may want to listen to the preceding OPC Foundation podcast editions or visit the website opcfoundation.org. Maybe you have a proposal for topics. Maybe you're interested in appearing on the OPC Foundation podcast. Maybe you just want to join one of the OPC companion specification working groups. Maybe you want to become a member. In any of those cases, please mail the OPC Foundation at office@opcfoundation.org. It was great to have you with us today. If you liked what you heard, give us a thumbs up, spread the news. I'm looking forward to have you with us again. And Andreas and Rico, thank you very much again for having been my guest today.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. It was our pleasure.
Yeah, we have to thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.